Blog Talk Radio.
Show. I'm
Lila. And I'm Leo. And tonight we have a special program. We got Larry Dorman on, who's the public affairs coordinator for AFSCME Union.
And today is May 1st.
It's May Day today, which is the original Labor Day around the world and is being celebrated around the world with many protests and general strikes and everywhere. Of course, you're not hearing much about it. That's why we're here. To try to give you some idea of what it means and what's going on.
And how AFSCME Union is celebrating it and what
they're
doing.
Right. So, look, we got a phone call from somebody here.
Oh, that's who that is.
Good evening, 907. Can I help you?
Hey, Leo. Tim from Anchorage, Alaska.
Hey, how are you doing?
Hey,
I'm pretty good. I see your better halves with you today.
Yeah,
I try to be here. So, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. I try to catch you as much as possible. Hey, do you guys do a chat room?
Yeah, we do. I tend not to put it on there only because it's a problem.
It's a distraction
for me to try to do the show.
Okay.
Plus, follow the news that I'm doing and fool around with the chat room.
I hear you. I won't bug you about that. But.
No, if you want it, I can put it up there, but I can't promise you I'll be monitoring it too closely.
Oh, that's fine. I love your show, and I would be just interested in what other people have to say if they came to your show. You might get more people if there's a chat room. That's all.
Well, I found that to be not really the case. You know, a lot of people, what would happen is a lot of people would talk about complete, total bullshit.
Nonsense. Yeah, I hear you.
Hey, Charlie, how you doing? How's your grandfather? Blah, 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 blah. You know, and it's like, you know, the chat room became like a Facebook page, you know?
We probably won't participate in it because we'll be doing news.
Yeah.
On small chat room. I'm doing that now. So let's see. You'll be on there, hopefully.
I'll be on there.
But
it looks like we've got a good show today.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for calling. I appreciate it. We're going to be
doing a
May Day kind of show today. So that's more or less what we'll be talking about. Let me put you on hold and let me put you on mute and I'll gotta get to part of the program here. All right, do you have anything you want to talk about or?
Other than we got robbed in our election up here in Alaska. That's
yeah,
the news I really have.
I heard about that with the Ron Paul thing, huh?
Oh, the Ron Paul thing and the Anchorage election for mayor. They didn't have enough ballots, so a bunch of people didn't get to vote. And then they were Xeroxing ballots and decided to take people's Xerox ballots and rewrite them on new ballots. So you don't even know if they properly put the right vote in. And then 75% of the machines were hacked into. The seals were broken. So what's up with that? That right there should have just had it squashed, but sounds to me like the city council up here is going to approve the election.
You got to be kidding.
I am not kidding you.
That's voter
fraud. It is the biggest bunch. It's worse than the 2001 or 4 election. Blatant crimes.
It was unbelievable. And the 208, who the hell knows what happened in that one?
Yeah, exactly.
Nobody knows what happened there.
So what is Secretary saying of the state there? He's the one.
Oh, they're saying it's going to fly.
Really?
Yeah, they're. I mean, I saw one, they yanked her off, but there was a lady that runs, she works in, I actually know her, she works in the city clerk's office, and she was crying. She was so upset about what happened with the machines, and they didn't want that to get out, that the machines had been tampered with, the seals were broken. But she was crying on the news. But I only saw it at 5 o'clock. It didn't come back on the 6 or 10 o'clock news. They left it off.
They're gonna censor that now.
Yeah, they'll squash that.
Yep.
So now
no one even knows it. I call the local radio stations, and they have no idea what I'm talking about. They think I'm some kind of liberal, and I'm not. I'm a conservative, but, yeah, I mean, it's, yeah.
Crazy.
It's shenanigans, to say the least.
You're entitled to vote whether you're a liberal or whether you're conservative or whatever you are. You still have the right to vote and have it recorded.
It should count. Yeah, it should count.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't care if, you know, Zeldar from the planet Neptune came down here to vote as long as he's an Alaskan resident.
Alaskan resident, yeah.
You know, I mean, come on.
But anyway. I want to thanks for calling. I really
okay.
We're gonna read a little news here, and then we got our guest coming
our
up
guest
at 8:15.
Yep.
And
well, it was nice talking to you again.
Well, thanks. Hey, hang with us, or just listen to us, and I'll
just listen on the show. I'll get off the phone here.
Well, thanks.
Okay.
That was our friend from Alaska, and we'll go right to some.
Yeah, I wanted to. I was hoping to get a little headline news, but I thought it might be important to read the column here from Council 4 asked me, which is where Larry, and actually Larry writes the newsletter for him. But it says Workers' Memorial Day 2012. April 28th marks Workers' Memorial Day. I didn't know that.
I thought
it was March 1st.
May 1st. A time for our union members and community allies to mourn the dead and injured and continue the struggle for good jobs that are safe and healthy for all workers. Council 4 members and staff gathered for a brief but solemn ceremony in front of our Workers' Memorial Monument in New Britain, where the names of our members who died on the job are etched in stone. Yes, they had a piece of that on the news. We honored the memory of Nick Yedeshevsky of AFSCME Local 1026, a Metropolitan District Commission employee who passed away last October. Nick's wife Meg, sister-in-law Beth, and mother-in-law Betty Kinnell, retired Council 4 staff representative, joined us for this special ceremony. I wish we didn't have to gather for these ceremonies, said Executive Director Michael Fitz, who noted that 14 workers die on the job every day. Any number of workplace fatalities higher than zero is unacceptable.
It says, I thought it was kind of interesting what they said, though, that Executive Director Sal Luciano said, their screams echo through the decades and pierce our ears this morning, said Council 4 Executive Sal Luciano, referring to the 146 workers who died when trapped behind doors locked by their employer. This was the shirtwaist fire factory fire in New York City, and earmarked the 40th anniversary of the occupational safety health hazard, as well as the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. In addition to the Council's 4 event, Workers' Memorial Day ceremonies took place in Bushnell Park in Hartford, where Connecticut AFL-CIO was a permanent memorial. At Washington Park in Groton, where there is a memorial walkway and benches, and in Bridgeport, where building trade unions members led a remembrance on the 25th anniversary of the collapse of the L'Ambiance Hotel Plaza. That was a nightmare, too, that construction workers were, I don't know how many were killed that day, quite a
few.
That
was terrible.
Yeah. So, you know, that's what's going on there, and of course, today is the...
Well, the international.
Today's the May Day, you know,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, covers quite a lot of ground there.
Yeah, workers all over the world.
Right, and you know, I was hoping I had something here.
There's nothing
on
that.
May Day. I thought there was something. No.
Mm-hmm.
anyway, before we bring up Larry, man, there was so much
Fukushima
stuff.
Is still spewing radioactivity.
This was such a frightening article that there's several.
Let's just read a little highlight. During a recent congressional delegation trip to Japan, Oregon Senator Ron Wyden witnessed with his own eyes the horrific aftermath of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster, which we have heard very little about from the media in recent months. The damage situation was apparently so severe, according to his account, that he has now written a letter to Irikiyo Fujisaki, ambassador of Japan, petitioning for more to be done and offering any additional support and assistance that might help contain and resolve the situation as quickly as possible. Luano, which many experts see as the ominous writing on the wall for the grave severity of the circumstances, offers a disturbing glimpse into what is really going on across the Pacific Ocean that the mainstream media is apparently ignoring. While referencing the fact that all four of the affected reactors are still badly damaged, Senator Wyman seems to hint in his letter that Reactor 4, which has reportedly been on the verge of collapse for many months now, could be nearing catastrophic implosion. That's pretty scary.
Yeah, and there was another article I wanted to bring up tonight. I don't know if we'll have time at that, but I doubt it. But we're going to see the they're in a position right now. They're looking at the leakage. Okay, from the Fukushima incident is about ready to poison the entire Pacific Ocean. The stuff that's going out there, it's just unbelievable. And they've already seen 300-400 times the levels of radiation in the California coastline already.
What?
Affecting the California coastline. So
imminent collapse
of
Reactor 4 could create a mass extinction event of both humans and animals.
According to Christina Consolo, an award-winning biomedical photographer and host of Nuked Radio, Reactor 4 has remained in such bad shape that even a very small earthquake could quickly level the building, sending the fuel from more than 1,500 unused fuel rods into the environment. And with reactors, four are still filled with the highest levels of radioactive MOX and other fuels, the consequences of this potential collapse could be far worse than anything that has happened thus far as a result of the earthquake and tsunami. Sitting on the top of Reactor 4 in a pool that is cracked, leaking, and precarious even without an earthquake are 1,565 fuel rods, some of them fresh fuel, which was ready to go into the reactor on the morning of March 11th when the earthquake and tsunami hit. If they are MOX fuel containing 6% plutonium, one fuel rod has the potential to kill 2.89 billion people. Senator Wyden is also asking U.S. Senate Secretary of Energy Stephen Chu, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and Chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission Gregory Jasko, to assess how much additional assistance their agencies might be willing to provide to help Japan and the entire world avoid a nuclear catastrophe of biblical proportions.
The scope of damage to the plants and to the surrounding water was far beyond what I expected, and the scope of challenges to the utility owner, the government of Japan, and to the people of the region are daunting, wrote Senator Wyden in his letter dated April 16, 2012. The precarious status of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear units and the risks presented by the enormous inventory of radioactive materials and spent fuel in the event of a further earthquake threat should be of concern to all and a focus of greater international support and assistance.
And
that's scary.
It's frightening. And we're
not really taking it seriously.
Yeah, it's really rough. Okay, let me go to let me give Larry a call. And I think that I wanted to cover more tonight on the Daiichi Fukushima mess, but We probably won't have.
We'll have. We can do
but
it tomorrow night.
I wanted to ask you to please go, if you want to check it out, go to intelhub.com and check out their article there. It's really quite disturbing, but it's something you should really be aware of. And okay, we're gonna call Larry.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. If you desire to speak to the host, please press 1 at any time, and the host will be notified that there is a caller in queue.
Okay, sorry. I dialed the wrong number.
You dialed the call in.
I know. That was really foolish.
You can get the. Yeah. Okay. Be nice if you call the right number.
Hello.
Hi, Larry. This is Lila. How are you? Welcome to
Good,
the.
Good, Lila. How you doing?
I'm doing just fine. Happy May 1st.
I know. The same to you. Big day.
Yeah.
Hi, Leo.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Good. We just read a brief article there on your on the newsletter. I didn't realize that April 28th was the.
I did.
Lila knew, of course, but
yeah.
That it was your Memorial Day.
Yeah, it's actually that's a nationwide, an international. Event now. Unions and safety advocates mark the anniversary of the Occupational Safety and Health Act, and this year, as you probably saw on our website, it was the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist factory fire in New York City.
I'm really glad that we bring attention to that because workplace safety is a very important thing, and there's always pressure by corporations to reduce the safety of their employees.
That's absolutely right, and the fact that we're living in this high-tech age doesn't mean workplaces are any safer or any less prone to toxins and poisons and
mm-hmm.
all kinds of hazards. So we had a speaker at our ceremony who said that going by the national statistics, about 14 to 16 workers die every day in this country, which is pretty shocking, actually. And
that is.
As bad as that might be, hundreds of thousands more are injured or made ill on the job and often suffer illnesses that, carry into old age. And so we've got a big fight ahead of us, and one of the first things companies do and governments do is to cut back on safety and training programs. So we all have an interest in trying to keep the workplaces safe and healthy.
Are there some jobs that are considered more dangerous than others, where that lose more people if 14 people a day die in workplace?
Interestingly, one of the, obviously there are certain occupations, construction being one of them, that carry with them tremendous hazards. There have been, unfortunately, several mining accidents. That's always been a dangerous occupation, and as more of these mines go non-union, that's where the companies like that Massey Energy down in West Virginia, they're notorious for cutting back on safety. But one of the leading causes of workplace fatalities has been workplace violence.
Workplace violence?
That's become a fast-rising cause of death. One worker obviously losing control and murdering other workers, or it could be a quote-unquote, client or customer who goes in and causes violence. So that's,
really? I wouldn't have guessed that at all.
Yeah.
Well, I can understand it if you were at Bank of America or Wells Fargo right now, but
right.
but I was very surprised that that the I'm getting off the subject here, but I it's been bugging me all day and yesterday since I heard it, but I thought I'd have to ask you. What did you think of this 56% pay increase to the police, the state police?
No, it was to the lieutenants,
yeah.
The lieutenants and captains.
What was that all about?
A lot of people have mentioned that at work, and I hear a lot of buzz about that.
A 56%. Yeah.
Was that what their increase was?
Yeah, I quite frankly hadn't followed that, and you know, I too was caught off guard. It's not everyone in that bargaining unit, and
mm-hmm.
It's taking into account some other factors too. But I'm not, you know, I don't profess to be expert on that one. As I say, I honestly was surprised by that.
On the spot.
I was really just surprised that I think it had gotten through like that.
What I didn't understand actually was that it was a bill put before the legislature, which nobody acted on, and they just kind of let it go through. I'd never heard of anything like that before, or maybe I kind of missed that things like that happened. It just
Legislature has, they have 30 days to take up a contract, you know, if it's a collective bargaining agreement, and vote on it. If they don't vote, then it, you know, becomes law, and I have no problem with that. The two sides negotiated. The state, you know, the legislature isn't a party to the negotiations. So, but again, you know, the captain, it's not as if every captain and lieutenant in the state police is getting a 56% raise. You know, there are pay adjustments that are going in there, there are raises, and, you know, by the same token, they've been hit with, I believe they've had layoffs and service cuts because of the going back to the state employee agreement. So
that they've suffered that, and they want to do, they want to do some consolidation in the state police too. I think,
which they're doing,
probably
right.
The number of people at the top, so that those that are left will be well compensated. It was just the way it was stated.
Right.
It did
kind of, you know, catch everybody off guard, you know.
With not any explanation as to what
could
happen.
Goldman Sachs CEO didn't get 50% increase, I don't think.
No, but by the same token, the state police supervisors aren't taking home millions of dollars a year and living in gated communities. I mean, they are regular working folks. So.
It's just that it's sad that the reason I brought it up is because it's so at the time that, you know, you're negotiating for unions, and unions are trying to keep their jobs, and all of a sudden, you know, it comes out with a 56% pay increase for captains
right.
and lieutenants of state police, which most people feel are terribly overpaid to begin with because of the overtime.
Yeah, I just, you know, and again, I understand that
it
kind of raises an emotional red flag, but I would... I'd caution people to remember that, you know, problems with our economy have nothing to do with, a state police lieutenant or captain. It has everything to do with Bank of America and all the corporations that are
absolutely
plundering
no,
and marauding, but I understand where you're
at. About that. I just think it would be helpful, and unless it sort of dies a natural death, that people understand the background a little bit.
And you know, they're not affiliated with us. I've had no dealings, so I just, you know, I can't speak to, you know, with great authority on the history and the background of that particular agreement, and it affects a small group, you know, a relatively small group of state employees.
Yeah,
I was reading today that there were a number of planned general strikes, but most of them didn't happen.
No, it seemed like very little actually happened.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, I also think that this stuff isn't going away, and I think you're going to see it ebb and flow and go back and forth. You know, part of it was there was some discussion or effort to get unions to have general strikes, and you know, strikes are illegal for public employee unions in Connecticut, and so, you know, there's going to, I'm not I'm not worried. I think that there's going to be more discussions and more communication between all kinds of advocacy groups who want to see some fun.
Well, we got a guy who called us who's actually not a chat room, and he's from Anchorage, Alaska.
Wow.
And he just wrote cops in Anchorage make up to $200,000 a year plus so, pension.
I guess ours were underpaid.
But keep in mind wages in Alaska for workers are generally going to be higher, and milk is like $10 a gallon, and gasoline is twice as expensive. It's I don't know that Alaska is any kind of measuring stick. You know, it's a tough place to live and work.
Oh, that's for sure. But
overall,
what?
Though,
I was going to say we. I had heard coming up to May 1st, as Leo mentioned, that there were going to be a lot of demonstrations, a lot of activities, and as he said, nothing really came to fruition. It was really through the Occupy Wall Street movement.
Right.
And
also through the unions. Some of the unions were planning on one-day strikes and stuff like that, but those didn't come.
Yeah, I mean, very little seems to have materialized, but obviously May Day still carries significance, and I think it carries a message that workers' rights are universal and that every person should have equal rights and an opportunity to have a better life. I mean, that to me is what the symbolism of May Day is all about. That's what I say, though. I think this with Occupy Wall Street and the relationship with unions and other advocacy groups, I think it's going to be a changing, evolving work in progress. Again, when you talk about general strikes, that it's something that, we've seen employed in Europe, where labor, quite frankly, is stronger and has more numbers and more solidarity and can do that. By law alone here in Connecticut, public employees can't strike. It's forbidden under law. So
right.
You'd have to see, some really kind of massive civil disobedience, to achieve
maybe like
a general strike.
Yeah, you think like unions, like I know the SIEU, I believe the Service Workers Union.
Yep.
Having some major revolt protest, but I didn't see anything about the Teamsters or the machinists or
Nor did I.
None of the major unions seemed to be playing a part in this. But yet, if you look at the European news, you got protests everywhere around Europe this week or today.
Right, and there's going to be a massive or major strike in England in a few days.
Yeah, England, France is putting one together. Greece, of course.
And who is striking in England? I didn't see that.
I don't know. I just heard about this, actually, and I'm going to go online tonight and learn more, Lila, quite frankly. But I heard there's going to be government workers are planning a big strike in about a week or so. So keep tuned to my clips, and you'll see it.
I'll take a look at that.
Somebody was just mentioning it to me right before, earlier this evening, and I didn't have time to look that up, but... again, I think that it was interesting. I had a long discussion with a private sector union leader today. I don't want to say who it was, but we were talking precisely about the stuff that the three of us are chatting about now, which is why do these things take place in one fashion in Europe and they happen in another or kind of don't happen here? So it's just going to be evolving. Labor laws are different. The climate is different, and there's a lot of work to do with mobilizing our own members for this kind of activity.
Are you thinking that there should be some changes in the labor laws here in Connecticut or nationally? Or
interesting. I think that as I mentioned earlier, the one issue by law, public employees cannot strike. That that's a statute. Am I suggesting that it's time to get rid of that statute? No. and or as you say, change the law. I'm not suggesting that. I think that the changes that would be most beneficial in labor law obviously have to do with the front end, which is organizing and forming a union. I think that the law is clearly stacked against workers. Employers get away with everything short of murder in stopping organizing drives. Then what happens is if workers are able to stand together and form a union, there's no incentive for employers to get to the table and settle a contract. So it would be good to see some kind of binding arbitration mechanism for first contract. So I think the labor law changes we need are on the front end, you know, which would make the playing field more level for organizing. And then maybe, you know, we talk about the back end stuff later. Certainly what I see, and this is just, you know, speaking for myself, you know, I've seen around the state, even with our own contracts, when they go to when contract disputes go to binding arbitration, we inevitably end up with, you know, an erosion in pay and benefits, and that doesn't serve anyone's purpose. So,
by the same token,
you know, we're not Greece, we're not France, and it's going to take a while to get people to mobilize and take to the streets.
How are we doing in recruitment? Are union members up in Connecticut, or we're staying status quo?
Connecticut is interesting, Lyle. We are one of the more heavily unionized states, but I hate to use that word because it's relative to other states. So I think about 17.5% to 18% of the workforce in Connecticut is unionized. There's over 200,000. Probably closer to 250,000 workers represented under a collective bargaining agreement in this state. When I say, you know, my words should be qualified, I'm not doing cartwheels in excitement over that number. That means, you know, roughly 83 or 84% of the workforce isn't organized. And back in the 60s, roughly one in three workers, American workers, had a union card, and we're much less than that now, and that's brought a serious deterioration in wages and living standards and the middle class overall. So Connecticut's in better shape than a lot of other states. The labor movement as a whole saw a slight uptick in union membership from 2011. Coming out of 2010, so you know there are some positive signs, but it is brutally difficult to organize unions. The laws clearly favor employers, and you know, coupled with the flow of jobs overseas that both political parties facilitated.
Yeah.
Which has destroyed the, you know, private sector unions more than anything. We got our work cut out for us to achieve a vision of a fairer, more prosperous society for everyone.
Are you, as a union, going to? The typical face of the union worker you thought of as a manual laborer, but as or working in a factory. But as things have changed. Are you looking to recruit more professional people into unions?
That is a great question. The short answer any union organizer will tell you is that wherever someone wants a union is where we should organize. One of the areas, though, that we're seeing some activity in Connecticut is with home health care aides and personal care attendants, because you know those are in the issue, because this is a case where public tax dollars fund those services. So the right wing is here in Connecticut, and apparently they're getting some help from the Koch brothers, who funded the Wisconsin anti-union activity. They're trying to dismantle to the best of their ability the Governor Malloy's executive order allowing the home health care aides and personal care attendants to organize. So
yes.
That's one area where you see organizing activity. Our union has seen some small gains, primarily in areas where workers aren't organized. And then there are unorganized workers in the public sector. I just did an interview today with the New Haven Register. We organized the West Haven Library workers over a year ago and are celebrating our first contract, which we signed off on with the employer last week, so two weeks ago. So the answer, that was the long answer. The short answer is yes. I mean, you have to focus more on sort of some of the what you would say is the professional white collar sectors. But, you know, I think that there are broad swaths of unorganized workers who would be interested in joining a union. And I think agricultural workers deserve to have union representation. We need the laws changed in Connecticut to allow that. So that's an area. But we definitely need to be more creative and more receptive to some of the less traditional work forces that are out there.
I think absolutely. The other thing I wanted to talk about was the minimum wage here in Connecticut.
I'm glad you brought that up. Yep.
I was a little bit discouraged.
I'm greatly discouraged that, you know, a bill that originally would have raised it to $9.50 over 2 years,
I'm sorry, $9.75 over
2 years, has now been whittled down to a 25 cent increase. And the original bill also would have indexed it to the cost of living.
I just think it was so unfair. So bloody unfair to
there was an article or an issue that came up last month, that it takes a minimum wage worker 100 hours a week in Connecticut to pay for rent.
Right. I mean, in a minimum wage earner in Connecticut,
to pay for rent.
40 hours a week is going to make around $17,000 a year. And, you know, here's the issue that the employers that hire in at the minimum wage are the, you know, the multi-million, billion-dollar enterprises like Walmart, McDonald's, Dunkin' Donuts.
Right.
You know, you go there, as you guys know. I mean, I won't shop at Walmart. I've never been inside a Walmart other than to protest it. And you know, I'm sympathetic, obviously, to the workers. You know, they're parents, they're full-time workers, and so these companies can more than afford an increase in the minimum wage. So the fact that a bill that would have increased it significantly and then indexed it to the cost of living or inflation, I should say, is now down to a 25 cent increase, and we have to do better than that. This is, you just said it.
And they don't, even want to give them that.
But then they have the audacity to give a 56% increase to some schmuck in a desk, pretending to be a.
I would never characterize state police as a schmuck at a desk. But I want to focus the anger where it belongs, which is at the corporations who are leading the fight against the minimum wage increase, because that's the underlying problem in our society. And this is the most expensive state, or arguably the most expensive state.
Oh, absolutely.
So. The fact that we're even having this discussion, and that, we may not even be able to get a 25 cent increase in the minimum wage, probably speaks volumes to the, to a, sort of a lack of political will right now in this state.
I was appalled when I heard them on the news discussing it, and how the most attention was given to the segment that they couldn't possibly pay 25 cents. It would just destroy their business to pay 25 cents.
And the reality is, you talk to a lot of shopkeepers there, store owners, that, they either don't have a problem with this or it wouldn't affect them. And again, where you see the minimum wage is employed in places like Walmart and, Target and Dunkin' Donuts.
Absolutely. I just thought it was disgraceful that bill had been whittled down so much that didn't even mean anything.
Right. I'm really, I'm really quite stunned by it.
I was horrified.
The fact that there has to be this argument at all and that even with the 25-cent increase, I mean, there may be a fight to get it done before the legislature adjourns next Wednesday. It is, as you say, it's mind-boggling, you know.
Yeah.
And I think it just speaks to a lack of political will, perhaps.
And it's really not saving anybody anything, because those people who are getting such a small wage then have to turn to public services for support.
Exactly. You know, we're supposed to be promoting and helping people achieve self-sufficiency, and yet we don't want to make it.
This is keeping people dependent and unable to be self-sufficient. I think it's cruel. It's not like they aren't giving them a day's work. I mean, they're working.
I was reading, there's an article I brought up here. I just wanted to read a little blurb of it, because it says, "Welcome to the Asylum, Capitalism, Feudal Quest for Money and Goods," by Chris Hedges. And I don't know if you've read any of his or heard any of his work.
I have.
He's great. You know, he's got a heart, you know, and he's sharp. But I just wanted to mention this, because it's brief, but it says it all, I think. The quest by a bankrupt elite in the final days of empire to accumulate greater and greater wealth, as Karl Marx observed, is modern society's version of primitive fetishism. This quest, as there is less and less to exploit, leads to mounting repression, increased human suffering, a collapse of infrastructure, and finally collective death. It is the self-deluded, those on Wall Street or among the political elite, those who entertain and inform us, those who lack the capacity to question the lust that will ensure our self-annihilation, who are held up as exemplars of intelligence, success, and progress. The World Health Organization calculates that 1 in 4 people in the United States suffers from chronic anxiety, a mood disorder, or depression, which seems to me to be a normal reaction to our march toward collective suicide. It says, "Welcome to the Asylum." So it's like, you know, what you're talking about as far as the insanity of not being able to give, much-needed workers, a 25% increase.
Yeah, it's powerful.
And then not negotiating, for a 56% increase or these obscene profits that are being made by Wall Street and not being regulated. It's just insanity all over.
Well said. There was an article actually in the front page of the Hartford Courant this morning, just on a tangent, about an increase in the suicide rate among working males. So, the economic dislocation that's going on is more of a psychological breakdown among men who can't provide and can't earn a living. So we got problems.
You heard about in Greece who shot himself in front of the parliament building.
Yeah.
5-year-old guy who was a retired pharmacist who they just took away his pension, in the austerity measures. It was
interestingly, if you guys should check out, have you ever seen the website The Daily Beast?
Yeah.
Go to dailybeast.com and click on the Stephen King piece. He wrote an essay.
Really?
I can't say the swear word. You know how they use all the symbols for the swear words, like in the cartoons?
Yes.
So it's Stephen King, blank, blank, blank. Just, it has F in there and then all the symbols. Just blank and it says, just blank and tax me. And he wrote this brilliant, scathingly funny piece about his willingness to pay more taxes, and it's a great piece.
Well, we'll have to go to that and take a look at it.
Maybe you can get him on your show. I know you've gotten.
He's a brilliant man. He's some writer, isn't he?
Yeah, I'll put it in my. I can save you the effort. I'm going to have it in my news clips tomorrow.
Oh, good.
Or Thursday. So
look forward to that.
Well, it's refreshing to hear somebody like that say, I'm willing to step up to the plate, because the tax code's got to be changed. We got to do things differently.
Well, Ben and Jerry were the first guys to come out. One of the first guys to come out with that, the first group, the founder of Ben and Jerry's,
right?
Screams, and a bunch of others, and of course Warren Buffett and whatnot, but. I don't know. I don't see any. I don't see why there's any problem with taxing these guys at 30%. You know.
No. I mean, gosh, they're already saying Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney's effective taxation rate is, you know, like half of Obama's. I mean, you know, you and I are paying, and Lila, we're all paying more taxes than Mitt Romney is. I mean, how does that work?
By percentage, we certainly are.
25 to 30%, the average middle-class worker pays, okay?
Mine's all gone before I even get my check.
You know, and these guys are getting away with 15%, 10%.
Sure.
Getting away with murder.
And that's why we
need economic murder.
And that's why we need to support each other, and I think it's really, really important. And it was really great to have you on this May 1st.
Thanks so much. I always enjoy it, and like I say, be on the lookout for the Stephen King piece. And let's catch up soon, and we'll be able to talk about whether or not they actually passed this minimum wage increase.
All right, Larry. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Have a nice night. Take care.
And we got Woody and Noreen coming up in just a second here.
Can we put his music on?
Yeah.
I thought you invited your country now. I invited you to your country. I think you said I had a house. But I have to be mortgage to have a
Thank you, Lila. How's my connection?
Pretty good. Speak up a little bit, though.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, that's good right there.
Thank you. Good evening, sports fans. Watch your heads on the ropes as you step into the ring with Woody. Tonight's topics, ESPN and the NFL, NBA news, and, of course, baseball. Let's get down to it with the NFL, which always seems to be in the news year-round, and I believe that's pretty much what the NFL wants, just to constantly be in the news year-round. As you can see, when the NFL throws in an extra game during the week, whether it's on a Wednesday or a Thursday, whatever the case may be, it beats whatever else is on TV. So the NFL is very strong, and God, if they had their way, I almost think they would be on TV every single night. You know, if they could figure out a way to do it, I think they would. But anyway, something a little more interesting, I thought. John Harbaugh, coach of the Baltimore Ravens, was on ESPN, and he was on a radio station in Baltimore. And bless you, Lila. And that's unprofessional, by the way, sneezing on the air. And they asked him about the New Orleans scandal. You know, the cheating, which allegedly went on, and I spoke about that last week, how they might have been listening to play calling and everything else, and Harbaugh immediately referred that to the New England Patriots and their Super Bowl championships, how those might be stained. As some of you may or may not recall, Patriots were caught taping pregame walkthrough by the St. Louis Rams.
Yeah.
Now, that was a pretty big deal, and it was swept under the rug rather quickly. You got to give Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, a lot of credit for that. How he was able to just get that whole thing kind of just quieted down and out of the media is beyond me. I think if it happened today, I don't think he would be able to get away with it. I just don't see it. And anyway, Harbaugh's point was, you know, he said you want to put an asterisk, you know, for those three Super Bowl wins. And an interesting fact is, since the Patriots were caught taping that walkthrough, they haven't won a Super Bowl since. Now, they've been to some Super Bowls since then, but since they were caught cheating, They have not won one since then. That's kind of an interesting little fun fact that may or may not mean something. You just don't know. Now, what I thought was funny was ESPN brought one of their employees to defend the New England Patriots. Former New England Patriot and three-time Super Bowl champion Teddy Bruschi came on to defend the Patriots and, you know, the alleged cheating, so on and so forth. And he kind of scolded Coach Harbaugh for not staying loyal to Belichick and that he wouldn't have his job in Baltimore if it wasn't for Belichick, so on and so forth. I was just amazed. I said, look how stupid ESPN was when they brought a former player, specifically a guy that, you know, played for those 3 years that are definitely in question, and there should be an asterisk, because they were caught cheating, and it was pretty feisty. But I just thought it was really short-sighted of ESPN to bring out Brucey, of all people, to defend the Patriots. That was really, really strange. And speaking of defending, a lot of crazy stuff going on in the NBA playoffs. And, of course, that's, you know, that's obviously no surprise because the NBA is just crazy. Amari Stoudemire, after a Game 1 loss to the Miami Heat, was wiling out in the locker room, and he punched a glass fire extinguisher case. And I don't believe, you know, he put on a show, too, big tantrum. And I don't believe he's going to be available for the rest of the series, you know. Typical NBA, you know, spoiled millionaire bullshit. I mean, that kind of stuff. Oh, it's got to drive teammates crazy. Amari Stoudemire is a major part of the Knicks. And if they were expected to have any chance whatsoever at beating the Miami Heat, Stoudemire needed to be on the court. But instead, he acts like a baby and possibly injures himself. Teammates must be just going crazy. You know, ownership has to be freaking ballistic. I mean, I know I would be if I owned the Knicks, and, you know, and that was, you know, I would just be outraged. It's really just this far. I mean, they're going to have a hard enough time beating the Miami Heat as it is, and now you have your second best player acting like a child. So, you know, but, you know, it. That kind of behavior isn't just restricted to the New York Knicks. You've got Rondo up in Beantown, Boston Celtics. Rajon Rondo. Now, he's been suspended for one game for bumping referee Mark Davis, you know, I guess he did that, I believe, on Sunday. So they suspended him for game two of playoffs. You can't bump a referee. You can't, you know, physically be touching referees and stuff. The league is not down with that. They don't want you putting your hands on referees. They don't want you trying to physically intimidate guys that are trying to get, you know, make a fair, you know, call a fair game. You can't be trying to intimidate refs. It's, you know, that's not going down. The league's not having it. I thought one game, I don't know, was a little light. I think two games might have been, you know, kind of what it called for. You know, you got to let these guys know, got to send a little bit of a message, but I guess one game was, you know, I guess the league figured one game was enough. But, you know, yeah, that, I mean, you've got the thing with Meta World Peace last week where he threw that crazy elbow there. I said it would be 10 games. He ended up catching 7. But, you know, stuff just goes on and on in the NBA. And well, these guys make a lot of money, and, you know, they just get crazy. The NBA is something else. Now, speaking of something else, let's move on to a little bit of baseball. You know, we got through the first month of the season, pretty interesting. A couple things crossed my mind that are, you know, surprising to me and also to other people that watch baseball. You got the Angels, the Los Angeles Angels. I mean, wow, they are just really not playing good ball right now. They are 9 games back, you know, of the Texas Rangers, And I certainly, picked the Angels to finish ahead of the Rangers this year, for the moves that they made. And I want to get to one move in particular in a minute. I'm going to talk about that because that's also extremely surprising to me. The moves they made and the money that they spent, I thought they were definitely going to beat out the Rangers. But the Rangers are looking real sharp right now. They've got a great lineup. And that move, signing Darvish, looks like it's going to be a good one. He pitched really well against Toronto the other night. I watched the game where Darvish pitched against the Yankees. And, the guy looks like the real deal. I think that was a really good move. I'm kind of jealous the Yankees didn't want to make that move. The Yankees are trying to save, they're trying to save money. They might have to go for a change of plans. Considering the sad state of the rotation, Hal Steinbrenner might have to scrap his plan of, having young arms help him keep the payroll under $189 million in 2014, in order to make sure this season isn't flushed. Now, a year ago, the Yankees did make a move at the trade deadline because they didn't want to acquire anybody signed beyond 2011. Ideally, the same philosophy is in place, but the rotation needs help, and I don't believe it's coming within. While the White Sox hurlers Gavin Floyd and Jake Peavy, they're signed through 2013, I think. They could be available in June if the White Sox are buried, which is a pretty big likelihood. So Steinbrenner might have to give Cashman the okay to make a trade for somebody making money in 2014, And, why is Steinbrenner going to do that? Because, he's got $207 million invested in this year's team, and he doesn't want to let the grapes, wilt on those lines, so to say. So, there might be a little change of philosophy here. The Yankees are doing exceedingly well considering that the rotation is doing exceedingly poor. The Yankee rotation is 25th out of 30 teams right now. And, that's kind of not what the Yankees are looking for. Sabathia finally pitched a good game the other night. I can't remember who the Yankees were playing off the top of my head, but I watched the game and I finally felt like Sabathia was pitching well and he had a rhythm and he looked good and it was against a decent squad. So, maybe he's about to go on a run now. But Sabathia is only one guy. He can only pitch once every 5 days. Other guys got to step up. Nova, you got to like Nova. Nova's great. I love Nova. But that's only two pitchers. You really need, you need your whole staff, which, by the way, is five.
Peter,
guys.
You have to wind up because we're about to close the show in about 1 minute.
Okay, well, you need five guys participating in your rotation. You need five guys trying to give you quality stuff for your rotation. And just two guys isn't going to do it. Anyway, that's it for this week. Shout out to all my woodheads out there, Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, Greg at AFS, everyone at Northeast Athletic Club. Weather's getting nicer. Let's just enjoy it as it comes. Peace out, everybody. Till next week.
Thank you, Woody. Guest, which was Larry Dorman, Public Affairs Coordinator for Council for AFSCME in Connecticut. And we thank our regular guest, Woody, for his sports segment. And please tune in tomorrow night.
Yeah.
We'll have a little more news. We didn't have a chance to present much news this
tonight,
evening.
I'm glad we got a chance to talk to Larry.
Because we celebrated May 1st, which is International Workers' Day.
When we do support the unions,
and we'd like to see workers get a decent and fair wage.
Absolutely.
And certainly I'd like to see the
You want to have some kind of equity in the system, you know? It's just like that's
you know, the poor
crazy,
minimum
yeah.
wage workers, I think they deserved a raise, and they just whittled it down until it was practically a slap in the face here in Connecticut,
that's
was terrible. But stay tuned for us tomorrow night, and if you can't tomorrow, please join in on Thursday and Friday.
Yeah. So we thank everybody, and we wish you the best of the evening.
And good night, folks. Our music. Yeah.
That's weird. Well, anyway, as much as I want to play us out, we are already out of time, so this is now in the archives. And here we are. All right. Good night, everybody.